You know, 40 years since the founding of Apple Computer. And
yep.
That's kind of nice to celebrate that birthday with somebody who helped make such a difference in our lives. I brought out my Inside Macintosh volumes.
This, Carolyn Rose.
Yeah,
she's
boy,
my hero.
She documented it all. And anybody who wanted to write software for the Macintosh needed this. But this is... Nowadays, you know, if you can get the Windows documentation, a full API documentation, it's similar to this. But at the time, nobody had done this before.
Yeah.
The ROM itself was brilliant. The idea that you build a computer that has all the primitives built into it, into the hardware, to do Windows and all these things that you're doing, it blew my mind.
The way you get software to be interoperable and compatible user interface is to provide tools in the ROM so that it's easier for a developer to use those tools. They can write their own one-off.
She doesn't have to write her own. If
you use these, you won't have to write them, and you'll look more like the other apps, and so it'll be easier for somebody who's already learned how to use one app to use another app.
It was a wonderful virtuous circle because, of course, you had the user interface guidelines. What do you got
Can
there?
Can I bring out
He's
this?
He's got something. Yeah,
okay,
bring this out. Look at this.
This is December 1983.
Oh, man. Here, hold it up a little higher there. Actually, yeah, you know what?
You managed the reflection.
Yeah, there you
here.
Go. Yeah. That is you,
this
of
is,
course.
Me. Yeah, I had a little more hair back then. This is 33 years ago.
Wow.
And that's Steve. And I look at his eyes. He's kind of got this little calculating look like, how can I harness this kid's energy?
This is 2 months before the release of the Macintosh.
Yeah. It came out in
January 24th, 1984. I got mine in March. I was a 100-day buyer. I went to Macy's with my credit card. I had wanted a Lisa so badly, and I couldn't afford that. But
yeah.
$2,500. I thought, maybe I can get that. It was the first three.
We all wanted it to be $1,500.
I know.
We
I know
were
it was
really
a great
disappointed. To get last yeah. minute, it got jacked up to $2,400.
And it didn't change the world right away. I think
no.
because of that price
Apple
point,
Apple almost died.
Yeah, it was a little slow, but people, you know, I got it the minute I turned one on and booted it up. The minute you saw Steve turn it on and it said hello, it was wow. And that, by the way, that hello, that first hello, written in the program you wrote, Mac Paint.
Mm-hmm. So this computer had 128 kbytes of semiconductor memory.
Wow.
This one has 128 gigabytes of semiconductor memory. A factor of a million.
Million more.
Million more memory. And it isn't really that much bigger. Somebody made for me, or made,
I love
and
this.
I got this.
I love this.
When the iPad came out,
yeah,
they made a Patentosh. See, it's a cover for
there's the hello.
Back of an iPad.
There's a, here, I'll show it over.
But
it's got
Mac Paint
over here.
On it.
Isn't that funny? You wear that on your... And by the way, I love it that you use an iPad that you...
Oh, yes.
You know, I think Jeff would have... What do you think Jeff would have thought of the iPad? Because he wanted to make... I remember he had... His vision was, you know... What did he call it? I can't remember.
The Gammon Cat was an information appliance.
An information appliance.
Yeah. He had a great heart. And some of the ways that he was short-sighted was that he didn't think in terms of a platform.
Yeah.
And this is why Steve took the project away from him.
Right.
Jeff was the father of the Macintosh project. Steve was actually the father of the Macintosh. Mm-hmm. And he had to take it away because he wanted to make it an open platform people could write for. The apps are what make the Mac worth having. And what Jeff thought was, well, it's like an appliance. You buy a toaster and it has
right.
a certain set of features, and you don't ever
That's
expect it.
It
to do anything more. Jeff wanted the Mac to have a 256 by 256 pixel display. It was cute because you could address it with a 16-bit number, any one pixel. That was kind of short-sighted, but he didn't want to use the 68,000 processor.
He didn't want a bitmap display. I mean, that was important.
Oh, no, he was
just
very early in pushing toward a bitmap display.
Yeah.
But he didn't want it to use the 68,000 processor.
Really? What did he want to use?
6809, a little teeny 8-bit processor that would have been cheaper,
yeah.
but wouldn't have been able to use any of the stuff that I'd written for the Lisa. So QuickDraw, because we were using a 68,000, was pretty much a direct port. I gave the sources to Andy Hertzfeldt, and he did a few tweaks to them, but basically...
That's cool.
It went in the ROM.
Assembly.
I think my code owned more than one-third of the entire ROM.
Wow. But that was more than QuickDraw, or was that just QuickDraw?
QuickDraw.
A third of the ROM was QuickDraw.
Yeah.
What was QuickDraw? Tell us about QuickDraw.
QuickDraw was the graphic primitives that Elisa and Mac used. When you draw some text, who turns the pixels on and off? When you draw lines or shaded areas with a texture pattern,
right.
Who turns the pixels on and off?
As
you
a programmer,
didn't want the
you
applications
just want
to have to do that. Right. It would be really, really slow.
As a programmer, you just want to say, draw a circle here,
Yeah. Shade
it 50% gray. You don't want to think about how that's getting
right.
done.
And it needs to be done very fast.
That's the key, isn't it?
I wrote software. It had to be done pretty much all in assembly language. Mm-hmm. And even with unrolled loops, where I'd had a part of the code, it would know we've got to do 17 long words across. It would jump into a table 17 from the end of the table, so it would do it there without any decrement and branch instructions to eat up.
Because that'd slow it down.
The computer was only I think Elisa was only 5 megahertz processor clock, and the Mac was 8 megahertz.
Right.
And so what you could do in a microsecond wasn't that much. So what I wanted it to be is such that you could use software driving of all of the interface and do it performant enough that real applications could use it.
Previously, it had been done in hardware, right?
I mean,
that was what
WAS
did, right?
What happened in Apple II is you put one byte in a location, and a character generator ROM would read out the 5x7 dot pattern as the computer, as the display was scanning. And that was very efficient, very fast, but it meant you could only do the characters that were in that ROM.
Right.
You couldn't do graphics.
Right.
There were a number of decisions that went in that were really based on Jeff's insistence on doing an all-graphical interface. The first was a white background with black text. Now, before
like a
this,
piece of paper.
Our computers had black backgrounds and either
green
white
or
green or amber.
Yeah.
And my argument, and the hardware guys on the Lisa team really did not want that.
No
because
kidding.
Because it would flicker more.
Right.
It would wear out the phosphor faster.
Right.
It required a faster phosphor so that it wouldn't smear as you scrolled. And my argument was, if you're going to do graphics, I mean, I can see inverting text going from white on black to black on white when you go to print. You're never going to print on black paper. You're going to print on white paper.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to have graphics, you're not going to want to invert them because how do you know whether to invert this part and not that part? You need to have a white
right.
background on the display so that when you print it onto white paper, it worked.
Right.
And it was kind of a big fight over that, and Jobs sided with me on that. He took my argument.
Were you with Steve when he went to Xerox and saw the what they were doing?
Yeah.
So how important was that? I mean, were you already thinking along those lines?
Yeah. Yes, we were. We already had software working in the lab that used a white background, that used a mouse that we had gotten. You know, I used my first mouse in 1971 down at the University of California in San Diego. In Kent Wilson's chemistry lab.
Wow.
And
but it was the Doug Engelbart type
it was
mouse.
It was a little better than the original one that was a wooden box.
Yeah.
But it still had two discs.
Right.
So it was kind of like an Etch-a-Sketch. You can't draw a 45-degree line when that can go up and over and up. It was designed as a pointing device to point to some text.
Right.
But it wasn't a good drawing device. That wasn't really until... I think Kelly is a design firm that worked with Apple to put the ball in there.
They thought of a ball.
And a ball mouse, funnily, you could actually draw in a smooth shape.
Yeah.
I actually convinced, I think Tom Whitney was the manager who had to make the call, but I convinced him that the mouse had to be in the box. Why? I had worked on the Apple II a bunch, and they had these game I.O. paddles that, little knobs and... Many people didn't have them, so if you wrote software, you couldn't count on them.
Right.
And I said, how are you going to write a graphics editing program that might have to work all by cursor keys?
Can't do it.
If you know they have a pointing device of any kind, I don't care whether it's a mouse or a tablet or something else, but if they have a pointing device, then you can do something by point and drag. Mm-hmm. And Tom Whitney bought into that, and that was why there was a mouse in the box.